Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.
The glow from the fire could be seen from 50 miles away. It started on Sunday, February 7, 1904, and burned for 30 hours. The Great Baltimore Fire devastated 80 blocks of downtown and destroyed 1,500 buildings and hundreds of businesses. The city had a young mayor, in fact, the youngest in its history, Robert McLean, 35 years old at his election in 1903, and he oversaw the efforts to fight the fire and then took on the daunting challenge of rebuilding the Central Business District. This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 207 for February 1st, 2017. Today, historian Wayne Schomburg tells the story of the Great Baltimore Fire and what turned out to be the tragic story of that young mayor, Robert McLean, at the center of efforts to stop the fire in February, leader in the effort to rebuild immediately afterwards, but dead of a gunshot wound in late May. The annual retrospectives of the Great Baltimore Fire take place this coming weekend. In advance of that, we'll tell you some of the story, including what we know about Robert McLean. The Baltimore Sun's archives, particularly a superb story by reporter Scott Calvert in 2004, tell us that McLean was considered a bright light, elected to run the government at a time when Baltimore was seen as an economic powerhouse, thanks to its railroad, shipping, and manufacturing industries. McLean was born into a wealthy Baltimore family that included a governor of Maryland. He enjoyed a privileged upbringing of country houses, private schools, and trips to Europe. In 1899, he was elected the city's state's attorney. He was elected mayor in 1903. He had been in office about 9 months when the fire broke out. Wayne Schomburg, who leads annual bus tours through the areas of the city destroyed in the fire, takes us through some of that history. So Wayne, I've always been curious about how they knew or got close to a source of the fire, how they determined what started the Great Baltimore Fire, considering what a mess it was downtown. What do we know about that, and what do you think of it? Does it have any credibility?
We basically know very little about it. We don't have any verification. There's no specific thing you can point to and say, yeah, that's where it started.
I was always told it started with a cigar thrown into a window.
Basically what it was, the Hearst Building was located roughly where, it was on the east side of what is I still call it the Civic Center, the arena. That was the Johnny Hearst Company. It was a wholesale dry goods operation, one of the biggest in town. And outside the Hearst Building, and you can still find some of these in Baltimore, downtown Baltimore, if you walk around, they're called sidewalk skylights. And they're literally a iron piece with round eyes in them. They're glass eyes. And they're put in the sidewalk to provide light into the basement underneath. And people walk on them all day long. And sometimes from walking on them, these glass eyes break. And eventually there's just an opening. And what has always been suspected is somebody Saturday night walking down Hopkins Place with a cigar flicked it away, rolled around and fell through one of these open eyes into the basement of the Hearst Building, caught on something. The fire smoldered all night long until early Sunday morning. It set off a smoke alarm. And that's basically what we think happened.
Was there ever a name associated with this, like the man who tossed the cigar?
To the best of our knowledge, no.
I could have swore that at some point along the 40 years I've been here in Baltimore, somebody wrote pinpointing the exact person who threw the cigar. But you would know more than
the
I.
The closest thing to that was a good friend of my mom's. Her dad worked at the Hearst Company, and he was the last guy out of the building Friday night. So they always used to joke at me. He's the guy that said it. And the thing, the other amazing thing about it is the Hearst Company kept a night watchman Monday through Thursday. They did not employ one over the weekend and had... we'd be doing a different topic today.
Now, the Hearst Company is considered the source of the fire because is that where the first alarm came in?
Yes. On Sunday morning, after this fire had smoldered for so long, it would set off an automatic alarm, which also registered in the headquarters of the city fire department, which was at City Hall at the time. So they then sent equipment over. They arrived. Now again, the alarm went off at 10:47. The fire department was right around the corner, so they were there within a matter of 3 minutes. So they arrived, and they pried open the front doors of the building, went across the first floor, looked down the basement, and sure enough, the fire is going right across the basement, and then the smoke is going up the elevator shaft. The captain at the time, his name was Captain Call, later said that once I got about halfway across the first floor and we're looking at this, we could hear doors slamming upstairs, like somebody was trying to close doors. And that's when he realized that when he opened the front door to the Hearst building, not only did he let his men in, he let in air. And so immediately pulled his men out and got them out just in time before the building exploded. It's what's called a smoke explosion. It's kind of like a backdraft, but it's technically a little bit different. But when the building exploded, it blew out all the windows, and the roof on the building was blown off and went across the intersection in chunks and landed on other buildings. So see, that this is the trigger of the fire. It's one building on fire. 15 minutes later, it's seven buildings on fire.
The fire swept from west to east, eventually crossing Charles Street, burning buildings as far north as Lexington Street. Changing winds made the challenge even harder for fire companies. It wasn't until 5 p.m. Monday that a line of firefighters managed to stop the blaze at the Jones Falls, a business district that had become the biggest dry goods market between New York and New Orleans, lay in ruins. Baltimore had a young mayor at the time. Boy, did he have his hands full.
Yes. His name was Robert McLean. He was the youngest mayor the city has ever had. He's from a very distinguished Baltimore family. There were diplomats. One of them was president of the B&O Railroad for a while. So it was a really very, very famous family. And he became mayor. And, of course, this falls into his lap on February 7th and 8th. But what's interesting is when the fire is finally the fire is brought under control, basically Monday afternoon, within a week or two, he's already organizing what would eventually be called the Burnt District Commission. These are businessmen and others that are going to put together a plan to rebuild the city. And McLean never, ever doubted that the city would come back from this. He always said, we're going to come back. It's going to be bigger than better than ever before. We're going to do this. So he puts together this Burnt District Commission, and then they put together a plan for rebuilding the city. And again, you're talking about 140 acres of downtown Baltimore, with roughly about 85% of it went up in the fire. So it's not just a block of buildings, if you can imagine. It is blocks and blocks. And of course, this was the opportunity for the city to correct some old issues. Certainly, one of the things that contributed to the spread of the fire was streets were much narrower then than they are today. So again, we're going to widen streets.
So fire embers could just fly across the street and more buildings were
on fire. That was the biggest problem for the fire department, trying to get in front of it. But the problem is, because the fire and the wind and the nature of the fire is that the fire was spread not basement to basement, but roof to roof to roof. Gary Frederick, who's a longtime fire employee, the fire department, gave me the best definition of the Baltimore fire I've ever heard. He called it an urban forest fire. If you know how trees burn, exactly how the buildings burn. So here the firemen trying to get in front of this to drive it back and can't do it because of the narrow streets, the wind, and also the fact that the buildings were 6-7 stories tall. So the Baltimore City Fire Department was state-of-the-art at the time. 440-some firemen working, 24 firehouses, state-of-the-art equipment. This is not an issue of not enough water, not enough equipment. It was there. It's simply the fire outstripped the technology of the day to combat it.
So the Burnt District Commission had as its charge future fire safety, changing the grid or the width of the streets?
Basically widening the streets. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, and not many people know about this, the guy that did the parks report for the city, Olmsted, turned that report in 1 month before the fire, and he was still hanging around. So when the fire was over, they brought him in on a consult and said, okay, what would you do if you had a chance to redo downtown. So he made some suggestions, and widening streets was one. So there were ideas being brought, but again, rebuilding, redesigning parts of the city, making the streets wider in many cases. So I always tell, when I do my course on the fire, I always tell students, we talk about the Renaissance of the 1970s. The fire was the first Renaissance for Baltimore, because a lot of those buildings were 19th century structures. So this was really the first city Renaissance in its history.
How long did it take, Wayne?
They got the plan up and running, and the famous line is, the devil is in the details, because although the plan looked well, when you start to look at details and people who are owning property and rebuilding and finding out now that they're going to lose some frontage because of widening streets and whatnot, that's when some of the interesting things begin. But it's amazing, the rebuilding. The fire's in February of 1904. They basically have this plan up and running within a couple of months, and most of the downtown was rebuilt by early 1907. The bulk of the downtown was rebuilt in a little more than 3 years. So it's an amazing, amazing recovery.
Were these businesses insured? How did they get the capital?
Yeah, well, that's it. Again, there was fire insurance. The estimated damage, and we're talking about an estimate here, was anywhere from $100 to $125 million. And again, that's 1904 dollars.
Right.
Now, insurance companies overall, when it was all said and done, the figure I've seen so many times is insurance paid out about $35 million dollars. In claims. So a lot of companies had insurance, and this is what they went with. Some companies never reopened. They're small businesses. I've talked to some people that have come to my talk where their fathers or grandfathers had business, little small businesses in downtown. They simply were wiped out. And part of the problem is, after the fire, again, you have a lot of downtown businesses now, because 1,500 buildings were burned. 2,500 companies are out of business. Where do you conduct business now? And so what they did was, they opened up the 5th Regiment Armory, which had just been built, and literally companies had a table and a couple of chairs, and that's where they were operating out of for quite a while, until their buildings were redone.
Well, sounds like generally the city managed pretty well,
yes,
to get through this devastation.
They did. How
did the mayor do personally? I mean,
yeah,
was he popular?
He was popular mayor. He oversaw the building. Again, we don't know how far. We don't know a whole lot about him, because the fire was in February, and then his tragic death was in May.
Well, let's talk
of
about
the same
that.
Year.
Robert McLean. Yeah. What happened to him?
Mayor of Baltimore, as we said, youngest mayor, came to office right before the fire. He was a bachelor at the time. And in May, early part of May of 1904, he married a woman whose last name was Van Bibber. And she was from Philadelphia. She was fairly high up the social ladder in Philadelphia. They got married in early May, really did not go on any type of trip or honeymoon. And what Mayor McLean would do very often, he had a carriage and horse. He would get out on a Sunday morning and just ride around and kind of look at the progress that was being made. So this was at the end of May. It might have been May 30th, if I remember my dates right.
Same year of the fire.
Same year as the fire, right. Just a couple of months afterwards. Got up, went out, rode around, took a look at what was going on, came back, came in the house, said hello to his wife, went upstairs, took out a pistol, and committed suicide.
He didn't leave a note?
No notes. A lot of speculation whether the weight of all this, with the building, he's refereeing all this building that's going on, whether everything just got too much for him to do. We just absolutely don't know. And that's the real tragedy, the fire, that we lost this young politician who really would have been a very good mayor.
So the idea that the pressure got to him is just speculation.
Yeah, it's all speculation.
Otherwise,
yes.
Depressed or something had gone wrong with the marriage,
right.
Already.
Or whether this was just one more thing on top of everything he already was doing, that now he had responsibilities because he was married. Who knows?
There are a few other things we know about Mayor McLean. He quickly made clear he was in charge of fighting the fire. According to Scott Calvert's story, McLean walked the fire lines like a field general. At 5 p.m. on February 7th, the mayor ordered the dynamiting of buildings in the hopes of creating a fire break. A dozen buildings were blasted along Charles, Baltimore, and Lombard streets. The effort failed and actually hastened the fire's eastward pace by blowing out windows of nearby buildings. Peter Peterson, a Johns Hopkins professor and author of The Great Baltimore Fire, believes the mayor became too involved. In his book, Peterson criticized McLean for initially declining firefighting assistance from other cities, for spending so much time near the fire that he could not be found on occasion, and for ordering the dynamite. Cool under pressure and decisive, McLean seemed to be the right man at the right place, Peterson wrote. Yet as he became more involved in choosing strategies for fighting a fire, he made some disastrous decisions. Peterson praised McLean's request for Maryland National Guard troops to help control crowds and keep order. But after the fire, clearly, the young mayor faced a huge challenge, and by spring 1904, the city's plan to rebuild was in place. There has been speculation over the years about what happened to McLean on May 30, 1904. Some believed his shooting death was an accident. A few even raised the possibility of murder. But city coroner Benjamin Hayden concluded that McLean had pressed a .32-caliber Smith & Wesson revolver to his head and committed suicide. The official cause of death, as listed on his death certificate, was a self-inflicted wound, quote, while suffering from temporary dementia. The Sun reported that because of the coroner's conclusion that the death was a suicide, McLean's funeral was not allowed to take place at the family's Episcopal church. It was held instead at the McLean family home at 903 Cathedral Street. He was buried in Greenmount Cemetery. A simple gravestone marks the spot, not mentioning he was once mayor of Baltimore. McLean's successor, a Republican named E. Clay Timonis, presided over Baltimore's recovery. Considering the scope of the destruction from the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904, the reconstruction of the downtown business district was impressive.
The rebuilding goes so well that in 1906, they decide to have a grand homecoming. This is in September of 1906. And they invite the entire country to come to Baltimore and see the progress. So the city is decorated up. I've got a photograph of City Hall all decorated up for people to see the progress that was going on. So it was almost like, hey, we're still here. We're back in business. Come see what we've done. And people did. It was a whole week of events. They invited all the out-of-town firemen. Now, when this fire got going, the city fire department was 440 members, but this fire was out of control early, and another 770 out-of-towners came and fought the fire from nearby D.C., from Baltimore County, all the way to New York City.
So they were invited back.
They were invited
back,
and there was this grand parade of the fire departments. You know, they came and this huge parade of fire equipment through Baltimore and all kinds of other events to let people know that, you know, the city is back up on its feet again.
And by 1907, it was indeed.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I collect postcards of Baltimore, and the age of postcards is really the first decade and into the 19-teens. And I've got a postcard of you're looking east on Baltimore Street near Charles and Baltimore in 1907, and you wouldn't even have known there had been a fire, and that was a whole area that was completely wiped out.
So coming up at the Fire Museum of Maryland, an event commemorating the fire, looking back on the fire, for people who want to know more, Wayne, you'll be there?
Right, yeah. We have two events. The first one is Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6, and it's called the Baltimore Fire Exhibit and Tasting. And people that come to it will get a tour of the museum and the fire exhibit, courtesy of Steve Heaver. And the food that's there being sponsored by the Firehouse Tavern. And they're going to have some interesting concoctions named for the fire. One of them in particular, a drink called the 1904 Ginger Apple Liqueur.
Mm.
So a chance to see the museum, meet people, enjoy
cocktail.
Some. Yeah, and have a cocktail.
That sounds good. That's on Saturday.
That's on Saturday from 4 to 6. And if people are interested, all they need to do is go on what's called Mission Ticks. Then on Sunday is our annual Great Baltimore Fire Bus Tour, and this is the thing that I will be leading with Steve Heaver, and that runs from 1 to 4. It starts at the Fire Museum. Give a little video on the fire to begin with, because it kind of set the stage for looking at Baltimore in 1904 and not what we know today. Then we get on a bus and we go down and we visit some of the key spots of the Great Baltimore Fire. And then we come back to the museum for some refreshments. And again, Steve has three pieces in the collection that were actually in the fire itself. So that's from 1 to 4 on Sunday. So it's done and plenty of time to get to your Super Bowl party that follows. If you're interested in information, simply call the Fire Museum of Maryland. The number is 410-321-7500. And they can give you the information and the price and the whole thing.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
For more information about the Great Baltimore Fire, specifically Scott Calvert's 2004 story on Mayor McLean, look for a link in the notes with this podcast. There's also a link to the Fire Museum of Maryland. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and please remember to review the show on iTunes. It's a great help to us. For my producer, Steve Early, this is Dan Rodericks. See you again soon.